I don't know if they'll qualify to talk to him when there's so much expertise.
There's no threshold here.
And since intuition is being allowed to be part of the conversation, I'd like to just say this sort of your comment. Even though I'd like to believe that education would help solve the problem, I guess, as someone who's making it my personal project to have an interdisciplinary education, I don't feel any more morally equipped to deal with these issues. And I don't know if that really will morally equip people to deal with things that we can't even fathom at this point, right? And secondly, sort of back to a comment that you made earlier, that I was just a comment, is normal any less dangerous than perfect?
I'd just like to speak briefly on your comments that you think educating more people about what's going on would make a difference. I'm not so sure that that's the case. It's been demonstrated time and time again throughout history that, generally speaking, humans and human history is governed by a very select, small group of people. And I don't necessarily think that introducing, I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but I don't think that throwing this into the high school curriculum would necessarily help things, would necessarily make more people involved in the decision-making process. It might make more people aware, but I don't know how many people on campus, Dr. Kirk, you might be able to answer this, were actually received the email about this seminar, and how many people have actually shown up for the lectures is an indication of how many people are willing to become actively involved in this process. Again, more education for more people is never a bad thing, but the number of people in this room and relative to the number of people that this information went out to might be a good example of how interested society is in this. And I'm not saying this
is being streamed out. There's also a lot of stuff going on.
Thank you. One thing that it seems to me that's very, in terms of how one might begin to approach, even cognitively, the ethical, religious, philosophical implications of something as massive as what you're talking about. I think one very interesting, very compelling observation for me that you had at the beginning of today's presentation is when you talk about this sort of genetic manipulation as, in a sense, the exemplification of an alternative creation story, if you will. And the reason that is such a compelling point for me is that it really demonstrates that what we are talking about here is illustrative of phenomena that are at the level of a worldview. I mean, this one might argue that this sort of genetic manipulation to which you're referring is the avatar of a modernist way of looking at humankind as having a sort of legitimate and Promethean control over nature and over the world around it. I think one thing then that's really imperative is to first of all realize that the sorts of scientific undertakings that are manifesting themselves in this sort of genetics research and manipulation, it is, to begin with, not a value-neutral enterprise. I mean, it's an eminently normative enterprise. And as such, it is connected to a particular kind of worldview. I mean, a sense of this Promethean stance of humankind vis-a-vis nature, where humans, modern Western humans, presuppose, in a sense, that it is valid for them to manipulate the things of the world around them for whatever end. I mean, this bespeaks something very, very foundational that occurs at the worldview level. And I think making that kind of recognition is something that's really pointed up by your observation about the creation myth. That, to me, is a really, really tremendous point, because it gives you the vantage point from which to realize that one can take a comparative glance at the way in which this particular worldview conceives of the essence of the creation of life vis-a-vis, say, other traditional religious perspectives that do not have such a Frankensteinian creation myth. That, to me, is a really fundamental thing to wrestle with. dealing with the fact that this is a worldview level phenomenon to which you're referring, not merely an isolated, instrumental thing that's occurring at some value neutral scientific level of process. It is an eminently normative undertaking that bespeaks basic assumptions about the nature of reality that are worldview, if not quasi-religious in and of themselves. Thanks.
Thanks. I just wanted to say the words floored and disappointed come to mind that we're sitting here in this educational institution and we're downplaying the role of education in the power, in empowering people. I think that that's speaks volumes about what we're doing here, perhaps, and what we're not. But I would really strongly support what you're talking about. When you talk about 15 years from now, it's the undergraduates who are going to be in the labs. And I feel that that's absolutely essential, that we're looking at both sides of the coin. And to kind of prove the point is that if you don't think it's valuable now, I'm sitting here as a female professor, I certainly would not have been sitting here 75 years ago speaking the way I am right now. And it's because we did educate and we took a different stance and we provided that. And the other thing to look at is racism. We have increased our tolerance of difference in a way that is unprecedented in the 20th century. And I think when you're talking about 21st century movements, I think we can look to what we have done and have accomplished and the methods by which we've done that. And I can't agree more that public education is going to be the way to go. And I totally accept the charge of being an optimist here, but I do believe in democracy and empowering people through knowledge.
Seems to me one of the scariest things about this is, and it's pretty scary, is the kind of society that we live in that produced this kind of information is the same sort of society that produces the scariness of it. I've been just revisiting recently some of the stuff by Carl Polanyi and Heilbronner about the way that market economies like ours are fairly recent inventions, if they're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That the commodification of things like labor and land and money, capital, made possible the kind of economies we've got and made possible lots of the things that we regard as benefits. They also make things like the commodification of this kind of stuff, which, I may be overestimating it, but it seems to me that the market-driven forces behind it are what make it the scariest. And also the raise some of the biggest ethical questions. But it's the market forces that give rise to it, first of all, and that generate a lot of the information that we're getting. But also, I think, that make it scariest because I would love to join those who think that the educational... I'm sorry. Very, very sorry. I remember reading... I teach critical thinking and ethics and stuff, and we read some of the studies about how much effect our teaching has on the habits of students about their ethical thinking and their critical thinking. And it's a bit depressing. But I hope you're right, Andrea. But in the meantime, I'm torn between thinking maybe we'll find a way in our societies which are so bent now on this market-driven kind of liberal value that says whatever you choose is a value, we disembed those kinds of things from the kinds of values that we have as a society, including religious norms that we regard as community things. We've got responsibilities to one another as individuals. That kind of drops out of the picture in our market driven. Whatever you want to buy, if you can find somebody to sell it to you, you should be able to buy it.
Including better genes.
And I think that's, we'll get past that some way, or there may be pockets of our human society that stand back and watch us destroy ourselves and rise out of the ashes. So.
Just to continue the education thing, I think actually, even though I'm not sure what I actually think about the end of genetic engineering, but let's say you do want to prescribe something against it in some particular way, I think you have to go much further than education. I think it has to be on the level of legislation, obviously. It has to be more radical action than just educating people. I think you have to be able to define what the legislation should be. But given that, I also think that I don't see the reason why people shouldn't be given their own personal choice to make that decision to do something. I agree with you that forcing someone or maybe choosing to do something for your children is really a problematic situation. But like you see already, artists, like Arthur mentioned, actually changing their being, like Orlan. Some of you may know who Orlan is, who's actually manipulating herself. Stellark, who's actually changing, adding things to his body. And I don't see a problem with that because it's a personal choice on their part to do that. It's a lot different to me, say, the GFP Bunny Project. I don't know, did you mention that last time? That's Eduardo Cac, yeah. An artist from Brazil, yeah, who's actually crossed Bunny with some sort of fish, phosphorescent fish, yeah, and made a glowing green Bunny, right? To me, that seems
allegedly
a lot.
Did he actually do it? Because there was some...
He holds up the green Bunny, and yeah, you can see it. And we know someone who actually was working with Eduardo, and she says, yeah, he's got the Bunny. I have a problem with that, because, of course, the poor little Bunny doesn't have any choice in the matter, but I don't have a problem with somebody manipulating their DNA to...
So if he did it to himself, it'd be okay?
I think so, yeah. If he crossed himself with a fish, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I also don't have a problem with the human becoming non-human. I think it's actually a little speciesist to suggest that the non-human is somehow less valuable, in a way.
Okay. Yes, please. Go ahead. Yes.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the education question, and more specifically, what I thought of was the divorce between history and science. And more specifically, science and its emphasis on progress, when there are clear, stated empirical realities about the errors, the grave errors that science has made in its past, in doing some research on reproductive technologies, for example, I am dismayed at some of the literature, and once again, the empirical realities that are available that has been cast to the margins. For example, early ultrasounds that cause cancers in babies from the pharmaceutical drugs that caused birth defects. It just seems incredible to me that history can be divorced from science with its emphasis on 15 years from now, its emphasis on progress in the future, when I think the past reveals so much. So before I look ahead, I really need to learn, I'm still working on trying to figure out the past.
I'll be brief so I can pass along to Sherry, but I just wanted to comment. I think Meredith's remark about commodification strikes me as absolutely one of the most imperative issues here that cannot be overemphasized. And one of the unfortunate ironies and challenges, we had talked initially on Tuesday about the sorts of institutional apparatuses that are available to give us means of placing some sort of governor on genetic manipulation. And one of the problems is that one of the prime institutional apparatuses would become intellectual property doctrine, which of course is a form of legal doctrine that valorizes the very commodifying impulse. So it's a real sort of unfortunate paradox in the kinds of legal institutions that in modern Western liberal society we have available to us. And it goes back to Conrad's point about some of the liberal values that we fear under attack. An unfortunate irony there is that the same sort of structures of liberalism are also tied in with the commodifying impulse that unfortunately pervades our society, scientific and political and legal enterprises. So one of the prime challenges, it seems to me, to be steered around is to face the notion that our existing legal structures, one of the prime ones would be the intellectual property enterprise, which is really, in a sense, the wolf guarding the chicken coop, or I can't think of how to put the image properly at the moment, but you take the point. I think that the commodificationist impulse that is at work here, and the sorts of legal and political structures that help to uphold and even valorize that commodification impulse cannot be overemphasized. It's a huge, huge element and challenge to be faced, I think.
Hi. My first comment is just about something that I thought of when you first started speaking, and
you sort of drew a line between religious creation stories and then the story of 21st century molecular biology. And I think that in some ways it's a false dichotomy, because I think that for a lot of people, I'm thinking particularly of a book by Paul Davies called The New Physics, and it's about how science is helping people to sort of rethink or rediscover God through science. So I don't think that there's always such a clear line between scientific discovery and religious beliefs in creation. They don't necessarily always contradict each other. And the other thing I wanted to say, I think Andrew might have said better than I'm about to say, but my research is on agricultural biotechnology, which is a little bit different than thinking through the ethics of biomedics and sort of cosmetic manipulation and genetic diseases and stuff. But my feeling recently is I feel really two ways about it. On one hand, I feel like we should just forget all about the ethical, sort of the questions about what makes a human and what is a real seed and what is a true fruit, and sort of just sort of leave aside for a moment all of those essentialist definitions of nature and really focus on the market forces and the political and social issues that have to do with biotechnology, because really in a way what a lot of people are opposed to is some kind of human control over the seed. And I think that if you go back to sort of the hybrid seed and look at that as really being the beginning of human intervention into sort of reproduction, and look at how seeds move from the fields into the labs, it really begins before genetic manipulation. Mm. So maybe genetics is really a distraction away from some of these bigger problems, or else more structural problems. But my other feeling is that maybe genetic engineering hasn't been totally normalized yet, and so it is something to focus on. It is something to really educate about and focus on, precisely because it's raising all these questions about a new responsibility that humans have, a new sort of political responsibility that we have when thinking about the powers of genetics. And I think that it's really important in both cases. I realize that somehow they're going to have to come together, and I think the important thing is not to talk about genetic engineering in some way or talk about biotechnology in some way that naturalizes it or that sort of frames it as a natural, inevitable process, but that really is clear about politicizing the issue in a way that we realize what the structures are that are driving the research and make those sort of as known as the possible ethical implications of what the responsibility may mean in terms of defining normal and all of these other points that people have raised today.
Okay.
I'd like to go back to the question. I don't have the answer, but I have a couple of comments about how to look for the answer. The question you raised, where do you draw the line? And it seems to me, as a philosopher, that a clue is to begin with the notion of self-consciousness. It's consciousness of self, not just of self as a lone entity, but consciousness of self as a member of a community with responsibilities, with a heritage, with a history, with a responsibility to others, to mutuality of support. Anything, it seems to me, that defines human beings naturalistically as self-conscious, as conscious without being self-conscious in that sense, is dangerous. And I think any form of genetic manipulation that damages or runs great risk of damaging the development of that sense of self and self in community with responsibility and so on is very dangerous. That's not a line, but it is, I think, fundamental to finding a line to draw. And I think examples of this are not hard to find, where we have run in the past, historically, into great danger of this, when we create a population with no sense of responsibility for their individual actions. When we create armies, when we create businesses, let's say the bottom line is money, or the bottom line is control or power, without any sense of interdependence, of developing people with individuality and personality and responsibility. When we talk about child rearing as though we're a mechanical thing, you know, you just feed them properly and make sure that they go to school, and those are things that lead to dictatorships. Those are things that lead to crowd manipulation. I don't know whether that makes sense, but I think if we're to work at finding the line that we cannot cross, and that we cross at peril, and if we can't go back, it's very damn hard to go back once you set that kind of dictatorship in motion, that kind of corporate mentality, that kind of control manipulation mentality, that kind of irresponsible capitalism.
Before you get it up, could I come back and ask you just to be provocative in terms of the type of questions that this author put? If I said, yeah, that sounds good, but I've got a procedure here that will give you a little more self-consciousness. Would you take it?
Well, I don't think self-consciousness is a quantitative factor. I mean,
Well, let's explain anyway. That's what the package says. That's what the package says, anyway, for what I'm going to give you. So you can have a bit more.
Yeah, well, I would suggest that the designer of the drug try to experiment on him or herself first.
Well, let me say this less provocatively, because I know this is... certainly, our capacity for memory is fundamental to learning, and probably to self-consciousness. We are working on memory enhancers, so let me use that. I got a package here that says I can give you a bit more memory.
At what risk and at what cost?
We're giving it away because it's a sample.
Your point is obviously well taken, because memory is a very and brain power and so on, IQ. But remember, we talked about emotional as well as intellectual capacity of consciousness. And I think that we run great risk if we... I think there's nothing wrong with developing the IQ. There's nothing wrong with the education that enhances children's and expands children's awareness of the world, for example, and so on. But I think when we equate a brain power with wisdom, we are in great danger of misunderstanding what human consciousness is about.
Well, let's try to be specific. This is good. We know that there is differential performance in school, and we know that in a modern society, and it's especially acute in places like South Korea and Japan, highly competitive social environments, in which school performance over time leads to greater possibilities for economic success. I mean, there's no question. So if I said that I had a procedure for your child that could give you some more, what would you say?
I would say look at the effects of overemphasizing school performance in Japanese culture, for example.
Oh, no, that's going to happen. You as an individual can't change that. But you've got a child in that system who's not doing very well.
No, I can change the system. I can call attention to its risks and dangers. I can protest it. I can develop... I can take studies that have been done on those risks and the damage done to individuals and family life and social structures. I don't know whether I'm...
Yeah, no, you could, but that takes time. In the meantime, your trial will be done.
But doesn't this highlight the point that short of some kind of transformation of our sense of corporate life,
of the kind sometimes that religions talk about. This kind of problem, I don't think, is solvable. Until somebody says, a couple of years ago, when my wife and I, when we went on the honeymoon to Cuba, and people are poor there, and lots of poverty around.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I learned from lots of those folks there was the concept of enough. There are lots and lots of folks there that were really badly off by our standards, and they invited me to their
home. That's
the
title of a good book by Bill McGibbon.
The concept, though, of enough. Now, enough, so I would be tempted to take the memory drug. I would be really tempted. And I wonder if I would recall enough of my own religious tradition and my sense of self and so on to say, you know, I've got enough. It's not as much as some people wish I had. My family says, so when I become senile, nobody will notice. But I'm serious about this. It seems to me that the problem is not solvable apart from some problems about our social life and our sense of selves as social beings, as embedded in societies and members together of one another. And I mean, the problems are acute and serious. But how they can be solved apart from that kind of solution, I just don't know.
Is there someone else?
I'd like to go back for a minute to what you were saying about quantitative self-consciousness versus qualitative. And I think that's a key issue. I just read an article by Ray Kurzweil where he was saying that with the help of nanotechnology, we would enhance our brain, our memory, a trillionfold. I mean, not 100, not 1,000, but a trillionfold. And I wondered if you read the story by Borges, Funes in Memoriam, where a child is confined to bed after an accident because he can remember every detail of every object he's ever seen or any event he's ever experienced. So it seems to me that inherent is when we talk about consciousness, what is consciousness? And it seems like sort of in the biotech realm, they're speaking in a quantitative sense. So they, you know, if you can map the human genome or you can map the brain, you can find out about consciousness. So, or memory. And in contrast to that, you know, possibly, you know, Proust and his, you know, smelling of the mandoline has some other aspect of consciousness that's not being brought into the discussion. And sort of to add to that point, when we're talking about the transhuman state and it being brought about by scientific means, by manipulating the genome, in the 50s there were notions of a sort of a transhuman state that came first in the writings of Teilhard, de Chardin, Sri Aurobindo, who talked about a future species that actually transferred life on the cellular level itself. But it's a much different vision than sort of a simple manipulation of technology. It has to do with the sort of qualitative bringing about this within our consciousness itself. And now, whether this can be facilitated in a sense as far as on a cellular level, that's an interesting question. I do think that many of these things go back to the qualitative experience of consciousness.
I'd just like to jump back to economics for a minute. There was this lovely series run by on the National on CBC about this family in the Maritimes who's being held hostage because the drug that was found using public money through the National Institutes of Health that could save their life from this genetic disease that they have costs $250,000 to $300,000 per year. And the drug trial has run out from the first manufacturer. And so now they're on the drug trial of the second manufacturer. And the question is, will the government of Nova Scotia cough up $250,000 to $300,000 per year, per person, with this genetic disorder? And this is something that we haven't touched on here. It's the same way, you know, we talk about genetic reproduction, things like that. We're talking about, I mean, at this moment, right, one pregnancy at a time, one woman at a time, one reproductive clinic at a time. one gynecologist who has these tests run at a time. You know, there's all sorts of economics going on here, including people who sue their gynecologists because certain tests weren't done and the child was born with a defect they might have known about had they had the full gamut of tests, which they then didn't have, right? So, you know, on the one hand, I don't think we can stop, you know, the boys of Brazil, if you will. I don't think we can stop some government, someplace, you know, messing with your dopamine receptors. And particularly if they ever manage to find a way to create an artificial womb and you're not then dealing with mothers. Although, given the totalitarian state of choice, you can deal with that issue fairly easily as well.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, I don't think we can necessarily stop some of Frankenstein's, you know, monsters coming out. On the other hand, at this moment, right, you're dealing with a small portion of the population,
mm-hmm.
the kind who is likely to be swayed by the notion of, you know, take this pill and your child will remember better, right? And so, you know, on one hand, we need to concentrate on that. And I honestly don't think we can leave it to governments to legislate, because look what just happened with Canada's, the biotech law that came through, right? Look at Australia, you know, they put down, and we're going to have problems with it here too, right, in terms of sperm and egg availability, right, that the sperm donors are now on the hook, so to speak, that the children can find out who the sperm donor was. So what's happening? Australian men aren't donating sperm anymore. Instead, they're coming to Canada, they're coming to the United States, and they're offering men vacations down under for, you know, a sample every day or so. And that's the way they're getting around this. We're having the same problem in Canada. As soon as the supply runs out, we're going to be importing gametes from the States, but they'll still pay for it, right? Because people here aren't going to want to donate. And, you know, for women, I mean, this whole notion of in vitro and the, you know, straight from the cow to the woman, basically. And I don't think people understand this or the risks that are involved with the drugs that they're taking. I don't think that they're being fully informed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where all the risks lie. I mean, forget multiple pregnancies, you know, caused by fertility drugs and the implantation of multiple embryos, right? All of the other stuff that goes along with it is equally scary. But, you know, at a certain point, I think we're on a cusp right now,
yes.
where the people who can have access to this are so small in number that something could be done if, as I said, we had the people who were willing to stand up and But I'm seeing a real lack of, if you will, big minds of this generation who are willing to stand up and say, look, this is wrong. We can't be doing this right now, and this is why. You know, if there's something that I'm bemoaning, it's that.
Yeah, that's good. There's some, we can sit around and chat for a bit more informally with some refreshments. It's almost six. I have to confess, I think that... Conrad, your question basically exposed the fact that I haven't made much progress in this. I think the answers I gave are really quite poor. All I can say, I guess, is that it bothers me, and I hope we can continue to work on these things. So thank you very much.